Hello and welcome to Volume 61 of Capital Ideas Live. In today's issue, we'll discuss some good news pertaining to the expansion of a paper mill in Alabama. We'll talk about how the drought is affecting seedling survival and wildlife. We'll also talk about getting the family together to do forestry projects on your land. And we wanted to look at the concept of human amenities and why people tend to live and work in certain areas. I'm Hayes Brown, the General Counsel of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, and I'll be your host for today's discussion. Why people live and work in one place as opposed to another has a substantial impact on businesses such as forestry. Sean Moore is a research associate at the Federal Reserve Bank in Kansas City and has studied human amenities and their effect, and he can explain. Welcome, Sean.
Thank you, Hayes.
Tell us about your work on human amenities, what that term really means.
Okay. Well, just starting off, the term basically means what are the factors that make a particular community livable? And the index is sort of an amalgam of five things that we think capture a significant portion of what makes a place livable. Just to give you some background on the index itself, I work at the Federal Reserve Bank in Kansas City, but we have a specialized center here that focuses just on rural issues. And the Human Amenities Index flows out of our current research agenda, which is focused on helping regions find a way to compete in a changing global marketplace.
Why don't you list out, if you can, those five components that go into the index?
Okay. First, we have access to healthcare professionals.
Okay. Second?
Patents per capita, distance to national parks, restaurants per capita, and natural amenities.
Okay. Some of those relate directly to forest landowners. Certainly the natural amenity index, and although distance to natural park is not directly relevant, but sort of relevant. Tell me why some areas rate higher than others on your index. I know that Alabama is on the lower end of the scale.
Sure. Well, I'd say while Alabama is not the lowest performer among states, there are some regions that tend towards the lower end of the scale. Several factors that could be at work just because of the construct of the index being an amalgam of several indicators susceptible to variation based on differences in the elements. California and Arizona, for example, rank highly based on exceptional patent activity, whereas Colorado, the western states, rank high based on abundant natural amenities and, of course, the distance to national parks, which exist more often in western states.
Mm-hmm. What could Alabama do to begin moving up higher on your index?
Well, I would say given the construction of the index, it may not be possible for Alabama to do so. Not because there's something wrong with Alabama, maybe there's something wrong with our index. And what I would say for the regions in Alabama, it becomes important to identify the assets that are leverageable on the global marketplace. Human amenities are one set of assets that can do so, but I would ask every region in Alabama to take a look at all the various attributes that make those regions livable.
Mm-hmm. And certainly while healthcare and patents aren't directly on topic for forest landowners, distance to outdoor activities or something that
sure.
Alabama can deal with?
Well, research here at the Center for the Study of Rural America and other places increasingly is showing the value to regions which harness recreational amenities and wildlife amenities. And these are two things which can certainly coexist with an active forest sector. It all depends on how the communities leverage those assets.
Okay. And well, thanks, Sean. We appreciate you joining us.
Thank you.
For the past 10 years, we've watched how paper mills and lumber mills tend to consolidate, close, and curtail production, but Charles Chandler has some good news to report. Hello, Charles.
Hey, how you doing, Hayes?
What's going on with the International Paper Mill in Cortland? It's expanding, right?
Well, that's what I understand. It's actually not, they're not adding another paper machine. It's just taking one of their machines and adding some extra to it, the extra equipment to it to make it make paper faster. And of course, if you make paper faster, then you need more pulp to produce the paper, and therefore more round wood to be delivered to the mill.
Mm-hmm. when something like this happens, I suppose it has an immediate impact on the local community, and I believe Cortland is in Lawrence County. Could you kind of speculate on what effect this might have on forest landowners just within the Lawrence County area?
Well, the impact on Lawrence County, from what I understand at this point, is that they have already hired an extra 25 employees at Cortland because of this expansion. If it goes through, I'm not 100% sure. It's my understanding there's not 100% sure it'll go through. But if it does, they've already hired the 25, and then there'll be another 125 employees in the future hired, up to 125. And then the on the landowners in the in that area, just a lot of people have planted the CRP programs and thinnings, and of course, Cortland uses 60% hardwood and 40% pine, and most of our CRP plantations are in pine. So any way we can increase that and make the 40% more pine necessary to deliver in to get the 40% would help in the selling of pine pulpwood. We only have two major markets in this area. That's Cortland and LP for pine pulpwood in North Alabama.
LP is what?
Louisiana Pacific at Hansville.
Hansville, okay. Could you also address what happens when a paper mill like this Cortland mill expands and the effect that it has on the state in general, the landowners in the state?
Well, it would increase the usage of pine in this area, and sometimes you get into situations where more pine is being put in or more wood is being put into a mill. In other areas, maybe they're not putting in as much, so landowners can benefit from the fact that I guess what I'm trying to say is pine being pulled from the center of the state up north to feed Cortland helps increase the usage, and of course it's a demand and supply situation in the prices for landowners in their wood products and their stumpage.
Mm-hmm.
So
okay.
By increasing the demand at Cortland, at times it may reach down, especially during winter months, if a person down south has a track that can be cut during wet weather. He may be able to get a pretty good price for his wood because those people need it in Cortland, too.
Well, that would be welcome news. Thanks, Charles. We appreciate you joining us. Well, hopefully the Cortland expansion will result in increased log truck traffic. You have to love forestry to say that. Most people in the state resent seeing log trucks, and these are just some of the issues that are facing professional loggers in the state. We wanted to get an idea of what life is like for a professional logger, and Bill Jones can help. Hello, Bill.
Good morning, Hayes. Thanks for inviting me to the program.
What are some of the problems that loggers face in some of Alabama's counties?
Well, one of the big problems they're looking at today is fuel. One of the costs are going up and impacting their ability to haul wood up and down our highways. Certainly, that's got to have some impact on their bottom line as they try to be profitable. But as you get in around the state, there are some issues specific to access to timberland, specifically because we have a secondary road network that we need to pay some attention to. And that secondary road network in some of our counties may need some increased assistance to make sure that we have the opportunity to utilize those in trying to reach the marketplace where landowners would.
So using these secondary roads like county roads and so forth is getting to be a problem for some of the log trucks, I guess,
yes,
because of the weight issues.
Yes, there has been a few issues in the past several months. There have been several counties around the state, Lawrence being one of them, that there's been some dispute over the use of the road and proper care and maintenance of the users that actually access the timberland, the loggers themselves, and trying to maintain and make sure that the roads were well-maintained and kept. But at the same time, we also need to make sure that landowners are aware that they do have the responsibility of paying their annual ad valorem taxes, and certainly a lot of those funds are kept there in the county for a lot of the services that are needed there in the county, schools and medical attention and those sorts of things. But also some of that should go back into our road system because it's there on an annual basis, and the landowner manages his timber over a period of time. Certainly would like to have the opportunity to be able to access the timber markets in the area. And the only way we can do that is by the trucks that we use.
Mm-hmm. Well, translate these issues, the fuel cost and the access to roads, down to the landowner who's not directly having to deal with that problem, but how do these problems that loggers face then translate to landowners?
Well, one of the biggest issues I think that loggers have to consider is when they look at a tract of timber is, number one, how far is the trucking distance from the mill? Because it's going to affect their bottom line is their ability to make sure that they're profitable and stay in business. If they don't do a good job of planning and looking at the cost of harvesting the track and actually accessing the mills that are in the area and ensuring that they can do it and operate and make a profit on it. But at the same time, there is a responsibility for the logger to ensure that he is a good steward of using that road, that county road that's so necessary for us accessing the highway system. And we have had three or four counties in the last year that have actually looked at the potential of looking at road use permits. Some have looked at bonding. Some have looked at different other means of trying to restrict access to make sure that the engineer understood where the logger was operating, what land was being timber was being harvested, and trying to look at planning the routes is to be able to get them to the nearest point on the state highway so they do minimal amount of damage to the local county road.
The engineer you mentioned would be the county engineer in that county where the roads are located?
That's correct. Yeah. I think for landowners, they need to have a pretty good relationship with their county commissioners and that sort of thing so they know if they've got a timber sale coming up that, yes, they are going to be able to access the highway system. Hmm. If there's a problem that needs to be resolved on the front end of the issue, specifically because you don't want to get a logger into your particular timber that if you're looking to access that marketplace and then the logger get there and then all of a sudden the engineer shows up and says, well, you know, we think you're doing too much damage to the road and therefore we're not going to let you use it. That becomes a problem for the logger and also the landowner. Both of them lost that opportunity to move that timber and also pass that revenue along to the landowner as well.
Okay,
building those the access to the logger and the amount of timber he has available for him to harvest.
Mm-hmm. Now, building those relationships with the county commission and the county engineer, I speculate most people would not know who their county engineer is, but it's a good time to know. Thanks, Bill. We appreciate you joining us.
Thank you very much, Hayes.
Lou Hyman is a busy man. Now, that's not news, but he's especially busy now with the drought our state is facing. He's frequently been asked by the media to comment on this, so we thought we'd take our turn. Hello, Lou.
Hey, Hayes. Glad to be back with y'all.
What effect does the drought that we're having now in Alabama have on seedlings that have been planted last winter?
Well, we're having problems all over the state with dryness. It's not just pine trees. The Agriculture and Industries Department just announced that we've already lost 80 to 90% of the corn crop across the state, and we're expecting we're probably going to have similar losses in our pine seedlings that were planted this winter.
What counties are most affected?
Well, really, it's turning into be a statewide problem. According to the Weather Service, we are in a drought situation statewide. Under the Crop Moisture Index, we are either excessively dry or severely dry, which is a polite way of saying drought, in just about every county of the state. Those little rain showers we've been getting have been just settling the dust and not really soaking in and helping the long-term growth of our plants.
What should landowners do from this point forward to assess their survival rates of their seedlings, and what should they do, if anything, or what can they do?
Well, there's really not much we can do except for irrigating, which doesn't pay. But we just need to be very careful, be aware this is happening, go out there and take a look at your seedlings and see are they making it or not. Later on in the fall when things cool off and we get some rain, look and see if they green back up. The Forestry Commission can come out there and take a look at it for you and tell you what your survival rate is and is it enough left to grow or should you replant. The other problem we have to be careful of, though, is wildfire. We're having a tremendous wildfire pickup because of this drought as well. So far this month alone, we've had almost 380 forest fires in Alabama in the month of July, and they've burned almost 4,500 acres. So we need to be very careful. Any outdoor activities, we're getting fires from cigarettes, which we don't usually get in Alabama. So please be careful.
All right. Thanks, Lou. Appreciate you joining us.
Sure.
Prescribed fire is probably not high on the list right now, but that will change soon. And to be ready for it, when prescribed fire can resume, we wanted to consult with Kent Hamby, who teaches on the subject. Hello, Kent.
Good morning, Hayes.
Could you talk briefly about the kind of contract that a landowner should have with someone who he hires to put on a prescribed fire?
Well, I'm not an attorney, and so I'm a little bit hesitant to get too involved in contracts. I think some of the things that need to be in a contract are a detailed description of the work to be performed,
mm-hmm.
and the period in which the work is to be performed, and the compensation for the work. The work performed should include the burn objective and any special techniques to be employed during the prescribed burning process, such as the use of a helicopter for ignition.
Is this something that the vendor can help the landowner with on how to spec out that? Because most landowners wouldn't know how to prescribe something like that.
That's true. The vendor should provide a detailed burn plan that's in accordance with standard practices and procedures for developing burn plans. But it behooves the landowner to know and understand the whole process, not that they're expert at it, but there's a tremendous amount of liability and the opportunity for substantial loss. So landowners really need to be pretty familiar with prescribed burning processes and what vendors should be doing and what competent vendors are.
We'll have a sample contract posted next to your image, and so you've mentioned a couple of things. But I want to change subject a little bit about and talk a little bit about insurance. Many landowners think it would be a good idea to have insurance to cover the possibility of damage to their land or maybe to the neighbor's land. Could you speak on that a little bit?
Liability insurance for prescribed burning is difficult. There's not enough of it done to build a substantial base for insurance companies to determine loss rates and that type of thing. There are two companies apparently that are providing prescribed burning insurance in the state. Davis-Garvin Agency, which is now working with the Alabama Forestry Association, is insured several contract burners. Their number is 1-800-845-3163.
Mm-hmm.
The other group that I hear about from prescribed burners is the Outdoor Insurance Group from Wichita, Kansas. Their number is 888-683-7808. But a landowner should check with their general liability insurance, their homeowner or farm insurance, to see whether that agent is able to cover them locally. So this type of insurance is pretty expensive, and so it's important that they get the best rates that they can.
Could you comment briefly on the statutes that pertain to the statutes and laws that pertain to prescribed burning? I think there's a prescribed burning statute now.
The primary law that all people who intend to burn must adhere to is they must have a burn permit that they can obtain from the Alabama Forestry Commission.
Mm-hmm.
They can find the phone number to obtain that permit on the back of the front page of their phone book or their Alabama Forestry Commission office, the regional office, or on the Alabama Forestry Commission's web page.
Okay.
That's the main one. The other thing to me, in the spirit of being a good neighbor and adhering to good practices, is to be a good neighbor. Be considerate of your neighbor and make sure that what you're doing on your property is not aggravating or causing problems for your neighbors.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thanks for that advice, Kent. We appreciate it. Forest owners frequently have strong family connections, and sometimes these connections are actually made through working together on the family forest land. If you want to start making these family connections by using your forest land, you need to talk to Katie Fernholz. And it just so happens we have her here in the AFOA studio. Hello, Katie.
Hello, good morning.
Tell us a little bit about how families can use silvicultural practices to have quality time with one another.
Well, I think, you know, the thing is, one of the challenges of being a family forest owner is there's so much work you're trying to get done on your land. You want to spend time with your family. You have a day job. There's all kinds of competing things going on. And the thing that some families, you know, don't always the opportunity doesn't always occur to them to combine some of those interests and combine some of the goals they have for their property and for their forest land with spending time with their kids, their neighbors, their family members. And what it takes is be familiar with the activities that your forester has planned for your property, whether it's planting or pruning or, you know, some invasive species control. Be familiar with those activities, and then think about, you know, the things that you can do and the skills that people in your family have, and then figure out which things you want to try and tackle.
Could you speak a little bit about how to foster interest in kids who typically might be found in front of a television or in front of a video game? How can you involve kids in an outdoor activity like a family forest land?
Well, it can be challenging, you know, but definitely I'm a firm believer that, you know, working in the woods can be more entertaining than a video game. But I think it's finding a way to get them introduced to it and finding projects that are engaging and provide a sense of accomplishment. I think, you know, invasive species control is a great example because you don't have to go through years of forestry school to be able to identify that plant, understand the threat that invasive species, you know, pose. And, you know, we all know how to pull weeds and getting out there and pulling a few and cutting a few. It really feels good at the end of the day to know that you got that work done. And certainly, you know, that's something, you know, all different ages and skill levels can be engaged in that project.
Do you have any advice for strategies to try to implement some of these topics that you've mentioned here in getting families outside and working together?
Well, I think the basic thing is to start thinking about the projects on your property as fun. I mean, my family, I come from a long line of farmers. And, of course, within the farming community, there's a long history of making farm work into a social event. And I think that's something for family forest owners to think about, too. If you're going to head back to the North 40 and do some planting, pack a picnic. Make a day of it. And when you're sick of working, stop and kick back and don't burn yourself out. But I think the bottom line is to look for opportunities on your land to both get some work done, but also to have some fun and spend time with friends and family.
Thanks, Katie. We appreciate you joining us. There's one thing we have a lot of in Alabama, and that's mosquitoes. And if you know where to look, you can also find a native plant called American Beautyberry. What beautyberry and mosquitoes have to do with one another is something Charles Cantrell can explain. Hello, Charles.
Hi, how are you?
What's this I hear about beautyberry being a potential natural insect repellent?
Yeah, this idea was really a folk remedy, and it was passed along to us by a botanist, Charles Bryson, who is with the USDA Department of Agriculture in Mississippi. It turns out when Charles was growing up, his grandfather, who was a farm owner in southern Mississippi, actually would show him a trick where they would cut branches off of this beautyberry plant, which is really a shrub. They would cut branches off, they would mash the leaves that are still attached to these branches, and they would put the branches underneath the harnesses of these stock animals. And as these stock animals walked around, well, these natural oils and such that come out of these leaves when you squash them, the same thing you smell when you squash a leaf, would just repel the bugs away. And according to Charles, this would repel the flies and the mosquitoes and everything else that would bother these stock animals.
Now, you're a chemist, so I bet you might have some insight on how this actually works.
Yeah, and that's actually was our big question. Well, first of all, does it work? Is there any validity in this? I mean, we hear about these natural remedies all the time, and you always wonder, well, is there something to that? And what we did was set out to go through an entire process where we identify if there is something present there. And sure enough, we identified a few chemicals that certainly repel bugs, and specifically mosquitoes is what we were looking at. We tested against Aedes aegypti, which is the yellow fever mosquito, as well as the malaria mosquito. And we showed that there's two chemicals in there, at least two, and one of them is intermediol and the other one is calicarbonyl, and we showed that they were successful at repelling these insects or preventing bites.
Are you at all close to bringing the technology to the marketplace?
Not now. I mean, it's a long process, and as you guys well aware, EPA registration has to be done for any type of repellent. I mean, most people think of something you would apply to your skin as maybe an FDA registration process, but it's really EPA, the Environmental Protection Agency, and that's a lengthy process, and we have to show how a human would respond to it as well, if it's toxic and other issues as well. But the fact that it's a natural and was a natural remedy and has been used on humans before as word of mouth through Charles Bryson suggests that it might be something that could work.
Okay. Thanks, Charles. Appreciate you joining us. We haven't yet heard any stories about deer crawling under the porch to stay cool, but if I were a deer, that's where I'd be. Mark Thomas is a wildlife biologist and forester who can let us in on how wildlife are coping with the heat. Hello, Mark.
Hey, good morning, Hayes, and welcome to all the listeners this morning.
Considering the drought situation, should landowners be doing any planning for wildlife, their typical food plots, or is that a lost cause?
Right now, I would just look ahead for cooler days down the road and prepare for cool season crops. You can disc now, go ahead and fertilize, get your pH fine-tuned. I'm using a liquid lime product now. About 2.5 gallons is equivalent to 2 tons of pulverized ag lime, and it's working extremely well. So when you do plan, I'd stagger your planting date starting at September 15th and then October 1st, the middle of October, and even into early November. And a good cool season mix of annuals is crimson clover, arrowleaf clover, burseem clover, Austrian winter peas, sweet blue lupine, and buck forage oats. And for perennials, I'd recommend Durana white clover, Patriot white clover, Redland Max red clover, chicory, and buck forage oats. And I can email you these and get them on your website.
Since you mentioned these specific plants, could you comment a little bit about on some plants being more drought resistant than others, even perennials and annuals?
Yeah, there is some drought tolerance genetically predisposed to some plant species, but interestingly enough, we heard a speaker a moment ago, I believe it was Lou, talked about irrigating forest land. That is not cost effective, as he mentioned, but I'm seeing a lot of my clients now actually irrigate some of their more productive food plots. So that's a way that you can kind of defeat Mother Nature, and it's surprisingly inexpensive if you have a water source nearby.
Could you also comment on how wildlife respond just naturally to drought situations like this?
Well, it stresses them, hey, that you can imagine. And there's a lot of clients right now that are providing supplemental water to game and non-game species and small game species, and also supplemental feeding, even here in the summer during the drought period. And what you'll see is a more vigorous animal going into winter. And, for example, supplemental feeding to breeding songbirds and neotropical migrants will reduce winter kill by about 70% if you start during the stress period in the summer or fall and continue it through the winter. So it is advisable.
Okay, supplement of these. This is a little bit off topic, but I wondered about how chemicals work in drought conditions where plants themselves are stressed. Generally, are chemicals as effective in this type of environment, or are they able to overcome it?
Generally not, unless you have a high humidity day where you've had an early morning dew, and in that case, you'll probably receive sufficient translocation through the stomates to induce mortality in the plant. But in extremely droughty conditions like South Alabama, where we haven't had a rain in 100 days, I would wait for a significant precipitation event prior to application.
All right. Well, thanks for those tips, Mark.
You
bet. Appreciate it. And that's all the time we have for this issue. Our thanks go to Sean Moore, Charles Chandler, Bill Jones, and Lou Hyman. We also appreciate the contributions of Kent Hamby, Katie Fernholz, Charles Cantrell, and Mark Thomas. Most of the areas of the state haven't had much rainfall in the past month or so. That's affecting the biological capital of the forest, from seedlings to wildfire to wildlife. All we need now is a little rain. Alabama is also experiencing a drought in the Human Amenity Index. Some of the components, like access to health care, are beyond our scope, but possibly Alabama's forests can play a role in increasing the prevalence of outdoor activities, which make up a portion of the Human Amenity Index. All we need now is a few more forest landowners. On behalf of the Alabama Forest Owners Association, I'm Hayes Brown, thanking you for joining us for this issue of Capital Ideas Live.